It's Friday, January 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry calls on nations around the world to help refugees. Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders seems to be gaining popularity against former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Bernie Sanders, not only is he not going away, he seems to be on a mini surge in Iowa, where Clinton has had a lead for a long time. And for a long time now, Bernie Sanders has had a lead in the second state that'll vote, New Hampshire.
And we'll revisit the capture of a notorious Mexican drug lord. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is calling on the world's nations to redouble their efforts to solve the crisis posed by unprecedented numbers of war refugees. He was speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. I'm joined now by VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins, who's in Davos. Pam, what did Secretary Kerry say about the extent of the refugee situation?
Well, he called for several new initiatives during his speech here today. One of it is a call for commitments from at least 10 new countries to contribute regularly to the UN humanitarian appeals. The U.S. also is pushing for at least a 30% increase in funding for global humanitarian appeals and also an expansion in the number of refugees that are resettled in other countries. All of this comes, of course, as thousands of refugees, many of them from the Middle East and parts of Africa, continue to flow into Europe, in some cases to countries that really have reached their capacity. The World Economic Forum is a mix of world leaders and corporate leaders, and in this venue, Kerry also had an appeal for the private sector, asking them to do more to help integrate refugees into their host communities, socially, academically, and he also said through employment access.
Well, now, in addition, Mr. Kerry is going to be involved next week. He's scheduled to be involved on talks about Syria's political future. There has been some discussion that those might be delayed. What is known about the status of those talks?
Well, the talks that have been set for Monday in Geneva have been questionable as far as the start date is concerned. Several diplomats have hinted that that start date could slip a few days. We had some time with Kerry on Thursday and a chance to ask him more questions about the talks. He seemed to downplay the significance of any small delay in the start date. He pointed out several times that it would ultimately be the UN special envoy who issued the invitations. And he also said that the talks would start out as proximity talks, meaning that the Syrian government and opposition representatives would not be in the same room at the same time. Now, Kerry has been meeting with key players. He has met here in Davos with the UN Special Envoy, Stephane de Mistura. Earlier, he met with the Russian Foreign Minister, Lavrov, and in his next stop, which will be Riyadh, he will meet with the Saudi Foreign Minister, Jubair. Now, all of these are key players in the International Syria Support Group, and this is the group which, of course, has been backing the UN effort to launch those political talks on Syria.
All right, thanks very much, Pam. That's VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins reporting from Davos, Switzerland. Well, in other news, a huge winter storm is heading towards Washington, threatening to dump near record amounts of snow and create crippling blizzard conditions as it moves up the East Coast. Forecasters say the storm could bury the U.S. Capitol in more than 60 centimeters of snow. It's set to begin Friday and continue into Sunday. Dangerous winds and coastal flooding are also expected. Ahead of the storm, Washington's mayor, Muriel Bowser, declared a state of emergency and closed local schools. Federal government offices are closing at this hour. Authorities are even taking the rare step of closing the D.C. Metro public transit system. I spoke with AccuWeather meteorologist Maggie Johnson and asked her to describe the extent of the coming snowstorm.
This is going to be it's a very large-scale storm system, and it is moving through pretty quickly because we're looking at about a 24 to 36-hour event for any given location. But it is going to quickly move out of the country and really out of the way by Sunday and leave us in cleanup mode. But there is going to be a very large area of heavy snowfall, and it is going to be a crippling storm system for parts of the Mid-Atlantic.
Now, when you say Mid-Atlantic, of course, there's Washington, D.C. What other areas, though, will be affected?
Okay. New York City is going to be seeing quite a bit of snow. Philadelphia will be seeing over a foot of snow. Down through Washington, D.C., where we'll be seeing between a foot to 2 feet of snow, all the way down to Richmond. Now, once you get south of Richmond, there's more mixing that will happen, and there will be less amounts there. But really, this is going to be a really bad storm for the Shenandoah Valley along I-81 to the west of Washington, D.C. That area is going to be seeing 2 to 3 feet of snow.
The officials in Washington, D.C. are telling people stay home. The metro has been canceled for 2 days. The area of Washington, D.C. did see a huge storm 6 years ago. It was called Snowmageddon. How does this storm, could it compare to that?
This storm can compare to that one because it has a similar storm track. However, this storm is going to be different on the southern edge of it, which would include the Carolinas, where they're going to be seeing more icing, which is also going to be a crippling factor down there. But around Washington, D.C., we are going to be seeing quite a bit of snow, and it is going to be accumulating quite quickly. You think that we're going to be seeing 1 to 2 feet in only 24 to 36 hours, the snow will be coming down heavily at times. And I know that there is just a huge volume of people that live in the Washington, D.C. area. And it is wise to stay home, stay out of the way of the plows, because the fewer cars that we have on the road, the fewer cars that we have to dodge for the plows to get out and actually get rid of the snow, because they're going to have to plow it. And then the winds are going to be howling. And that's the other thing, is that cleaning up, just because the snow plow comes through, it's not going to take very long for the winds, the strong winds, to whip the snow right back to where they just cleared out. So even though a snow plow might go through, again, we're going to be dealing with low visibilities because of the blowing and drifting of the snow because of the strong winds.
That's AccuWeather meteorologist Maggie Johnson. Well, looking at social media, there's even a hashtag called Blizzard2016. Washington, D.C.-based Christo Doyle tweets, "I will try to survive Blizzard 2016 with my kids in the backyard. Igloo time." Chester tweets, "Blizzard 2016, I hope we get so much snow." Further north, Scott Woolidge tweets, "As Blizzard 2016 is set to slam New Jersey, Governor Christie is literally phoning it in to his constituents from New Hampshire." We should note that Governor Chris Christie is campaigning for the Republican nomination for president in New Hampshire. Well, and Andy Lassner from California, he has the nerve to tweet, "May dip down here in Los Angeles to the low 60s today, Blizzard 2016. This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
Scientists say that Earth was once like a giant snowball and coated with a thick layer of ice about 640 to 720 million years ago. Many think that this period of heavy glaciation was due to a change in the ocean's chemistry and a significant drop in atmospheric carbon dioxide levels brought on by the breakup of the supercontinent known as Rodinia. New research indicates that as ice coated the Earth's surface, volcanoes were violently erupting under the surface of the planet's oceans. Researchers say that carbon dioxide produced by these underwater volcanoes eventually made its way into the atmosphere, which warmed it enough to melt the thick ice that covered the planet. A buildup of material from these volcanoes also helped change ocean chemistry that released large amounts of calcium, magnesium, and phosphorus. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about the recapture of the notorious drug lord, El Chapo. Two former Burundian presidents have appealed to the UN Security Council to press the current government to accept an African Union-led peacekeeping force. Well, meanwhile, Burundi's current president, Pierre Nkurunziza, is firmly opposed to such a force. The UN Security Council representatives arrived in Burundi's capital late Thursday on its second visit in less than a year. I spoke with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir, who's traveling with the council delegation. What is the UN team looking to there?
The Security Council is on its second day visiting Burundi today, and they've had a whole series of meetings so far today with members of civil society, from the opposition, from the government, religious leaders, political party leaders, and I think they heard a whole array of messages, but really, in a way, nothing new, because as you would expect, the opposition is telling you that things are very bad here, and the government is telling you that there's not a problem. So I think a lot of what they heard today, they've heard before, but they're here on the ground and they're feeling out people on a number of subjects, including on getting the country to move towards dialogue. I think that's really one of the big messages that the Security Council is here to deliver, that they want to press the parties to have a full and a real peace, to respect the Arusha Accords that ended this country's previous conflict. And they are really meeting all levels of society to try and convey that message and to hear from them.
Now, I believe the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, is she on this trip?
Yes, she's one of the co-leaders along with the ambassador of Angola and the French deputy ambassador. And so they have been conducting these meetings together, and the council is going to go to Gatanga province today to meet with President Pierre Nkurunziza. That's their next meeting on this Friday here in Burundi.
All right, well, thanks very much, Margaret. That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir reporting from Bujumbura, Burundi. Voters will finally weigh in on the U.S. presidential race in just under 2 weeks, when the Iowa caucuses select early favorites. Among the Democrats, Bernie Sanders has made an amazing surge in the polls over Hillary Clinton. VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone joined International Edition's Jim Stevenson to elaborate on this development.
We've focused so much over the past 6 months or so on the rise of Donald Trump in the Republican race, in a way that's overshadowed what's going on in the Democratic race. And a lot of people may be now readjusting their predictions because Bernie Sanders, not only is he not going away, he seems to be on a mini surge in Iowa, where Clinton has had a lead for a long time. And for a long time now, Bernie Sanders has had a lead in the second state that'll vote, New Hampshire, which holds its primary on February 9th. So a 1-2 punch of Sanders defeating Clinton in both Iowa and New Hampshire certainly would reset the race. It might not make Sanders the favorite for the nomination. Clinton would still seem to be a strong contender. She still has great strengths with minority voters, which are a really important part of the Democratic Party. But we see of late Bernie Sanders trying to fix that a bit by reaching out to African-American and other minorities to try to bolster his support there. But yeah, you know, on one hand, the Trump phenomenon on the Republican side and the Sanders phenomenon on the Democratic side, unorthodox candidates, outsiders, it seems to be the rage for both parties this year.
What are some of the issues that Bernie Sanders is bringing up that are resonating with voters?
Well, you know, he has from the beginning focused on this sort of inequality argument, that too much wealth in America is concentrated in too few people, the billionaire class, he likes to call them. I think there's some studies that shows there's several hundred, 500 billionaires in the country. So that's a pretty small group. But this argument that Sanders has been making, that there's been too much concentration of wealth, seems to be having an impact. And, you know, a lot of the candidates are trying to appeal to the broader middle class. And whether it's an economic argument that we've heard from Sanders, or in the case of Trump, it might be more of a grievance argument, that it's time to settle some old scores and people are angry and upset. Both of these things seem to be reaching voters right now. And I think all the other candidates are taking note. In the case of Hillary Clinton, she's very well known. She offers an experienced candidate. I think they're just a little taken aback at how resilient Sanders has proven. They have their work cut out for them.
Hillary Clinton was, for a while, the presumed nominee for the Democrats back in 2008, and then came Barack Obama. Does the Hillary camp see shades of 2008 starting to reemerge?
They really don't want to go down that road. And some of the supporters, I think, are getting a little worried that we're sitting in the theater and we've seen this movie before. That's why I think they're doubling down now on their efforts in Iowa to make sure the organization gets those people out on a cold winter's night. You actually have to go out in Iowa to a local community center and vote. It's not as though you're going to the polls anytime during the day you want. You actually have to go to a meeting at night. People are trying to convince neighbors who to vote for. And we'll see, you know, who's better organized in Iowa. The Clinton camp says they learned an important lesson from that loss in 2008 to Barack Obama. The question about Sanders is he mobilizing people who normally wouldn't go to vote in the caucuses? I think it's a real tight battle right now. And the Clinton people know that the best place to stop Sanders is at the beginning, because otherwise he could be on a bit of a run with what, according to one recent poll in New Hampshire, is quite a large lead.
Well, it's always fascinating to watch the run-up and, of course, then actually see how voters turn out and cast their ballots. And we're looking forward to that. Along the way, every step of the way, our VOA senior political correspondent, Jim Malone. Jim, thanks for stopping by.
Always a pleasure.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. The Mexican government's dramatic recapture of drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman earlier this month is shining a new spotlight on its handling of the war on illegal narcotics. Rolling Stone magazine's new report that El Chapo met secretly with Hollywood actor Sean Penn and Mexican TV star Kate Del Castillo while on the run last October has fueled social media interest in the issue even more. The El Chapo saga was the topic of this week's hashtag VOA TV program, and host Michael Lippin joins us to share a highlight from the show.
This week we looked at how social media have responded to El Chapo's recapture and his interview with Sean Penn for Rolling Stone magazine. We had two guests joining us via Skype. From Phoenix, Arizona, we had journalism professor Angela Corcherga, and from Mexico City, we had investigative journalist John Ackerman. Now, during the show, I asked Ackerman whether we learned anything new from Penn's story.
I think Sean Penn's article was very important, particularly because it points to government complicity and the complicity of international corporations with this international business of death and drugs. Sean Penn's very clear about the complicity of the Mexican military with the Chapo Guzman, and also mentions direct statements from Chapo Guzman in which he talks about important multinational corporations who do money laundering for him. This is not new information, of course, but one of the reasons why so much attention has been put on Sean Penn and Kate Del Castillo is actually an explicit strategy by the Mexican government. The Mexican government announces that they captured him, by the way, on Friday. Only once the article comes out, which is the day after, it's just Saturday, the capture was on Friday, the article came out on Saturday, and then on Sunday, the Mexican government then starts to push this story that somehow Sean Penn and Kate Del Castillo are the responsible ones to deflect attention precisely, which should be on the Mexican government, on U.S. drug users and the United States government, towards this issue of of Hollywood stars. During the following days, they let out messages that had been exchanged between Keck del Castillo and El Chapo's lawyer to sort of feed this media frenzy. And yes, I would agree there with Sean Penn when he said that in some ways his article has failed because the attention's all on him and Keck del Castillo, when actually that article and the issues it talks about should lead to serious soul-searching, both in the United States and Mexico.
Angela Cochurga in Phoenix, John was talking about all the corruption issues that are raised with this article, but what about all the violence perpetrated by the cartel, by El Chapo's cartel? That wasn't really covered much in Sean Penn's piece. Do people have a sense that he failed partly in that aspect as well?
Well, he's sad about the state of journalism, but he didn't seem very sad about the countless bodies, the body count that we've seen because of the drug war. Obviously not just the Sinaloa cartel. You know, Chapo says that he only goes after rivals who challenge him. But, you know, having covered in what is multiple mass murders, and I don't want to get too graphic, with just blood running through the streets, it's very difficult to see how he could just say, well, he's a poor farmer who was forced into the drug business, and it's all blamed on U.S. consumption, which is a very, very serious problem. We're not going to downplay that part. But, you know, I've gone to neighborhoods in Juarez after a massacre at a rehab center where young people who were trying to get off of drugs were there trying it as best they could. They were attacked because they had been part of the drug trade. I interviewed a young boy who lost his brother in that massacre, and just a year before I'd lost another brother. And his mother was sobbing inside the house. I mean, there was a real toll. That neighborhood, every single child I talked to in that neighborhood had experienced violence, had lost a parent, had lost a friend, had lost a relative. I went back to check on that young boy. There were no more young boys in that neighborhood. They had either fled or been killed because of this street-level drug violence in Juarez. So there is a real toll, and none of that was touched upon in the article.
Well, if you'd like to hear more of that conversation on the El Chapo saga, just go to our Facebook page, which is called #VOA.
Thank you to Michael Lippin. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend and stay safe from the snowstorm.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. 8 candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986 but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a 5th term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society, obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aini, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.